Thank you. Thank you. Chamber Music from Johannes Brahms, completed in 1882, Piano Trio No. 2 in C Major, performed by violinist Itzhak Perlman, cellist Lynn Harrell, and at piano, Vladimir Ashkenazi, on Kansas Public Radio, where it's just about 1:42, and at the top of the hour, news from NPR. Support for classical music on KPR comes from Spider Arc Constructors, offering hardscaping across the KPR listening area, including patios and retaining walls. More information about creating your backyard oasis is at Spider Art, Spider with a Y, SpiderArtConstructors.com, and the Noto Arts and Entertainment District of Topeka, inviting listeners to the Dia de los Muertos Festival Friday, featuring the Celebration of Souls exhibit on loan from the Chicago Field Museum. Details at explorenoto.org. What we have for you next is brought to us by the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra. The other day I was being a nerd and watching a history documentary about ancient Rome, the time of Augustus Caesar, and about how he had a top general and political ally by the name of Marcus Agrippa, who in the lifetime of Augustus was responsible for restoring the city of Rome, bringing in new roads, aqueducts, and more importantly, fountains, so that no Roman in the city would be but a short walking distance away from a fresh source of water. And that got me thinking about an orchestral suite that Ottorino Respighi wrote in 1916, one of three great suites he wrote on the subject of Rome, in this case, Fountains of Rome, representing the Val Giulia, the Triton, Trevi, and Villa Medici fountains. Maris Jensens conducts the Oslo Philharmonic on Kansas Public Radio. composed in 1916, The Fountains of Rome. Music of Ottorino Respighi and one of three great orchestral suites composed on the subject of the city of Rome. Maris Janssens and the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra had today's performance. It is 2 o'clock and about time for NPR News. More classical music awaits us in the next hour, where the Kansas City Symphony is ready with the first symphony of Samuel Barber. We've got that and more still to come. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute, and online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for news on KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, offering zoo memberships for individuals and families alike for unlimited admission to the zoo year-round. Details on the benefits of a Topeka Zoo membership can be found at topekazoo.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Republicans in Virginia are asking the Supreme Court to remove 1,600 people from the state's voter rolls. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports the appeal follows two lower court decisions that found the state was illegally purging voters from the rolls during the 90-day period prior to the election.
Virginia's Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin signed an executive order on the 90th day prior to the election. It permitted systematic voting roll purges to continue in order to prevent non-citizens from voting, he said. The Justice Department and voting rights groups challenged the move, and two lower courts ruled in their favor, blocking Youngkin's purge order. Both courts said the order is illegal under a federal law that bars such systematic purges in the 90 days leading up to an election. Now, with just 8 days before the election, Virginia is asking the Supreme Court to allow the voter purges to continue. The case is the first of what are likely to be multiple election appeals that will come before the Supreme Court in the coming days and even weeks. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
NATO has confirmed that North Korea has sent troops to assist Russia in its invasion of Ukraine. The alliance is demanding the two countries end this cooperation, which is seen as a major escalation in the conflict. Terry Schultz reports the NATO Secretary General says this development is a threat to global security.
NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte spoke after South Korean intelligence officials shared their assessment that thousands of North Korean troops are now on the ground in Russia.
The deepening military cooperation between Russia and North Korea is a threat to both the Indo-Pacific and Euro-Atlantic security.
Lithuania's ambassador to NATO, Davidas Matulionis, says allies are discussing their options.
About the concrete actions which are needed to deter Russia and North Korea to continue cooperating.
South Korea is reportedly considering providing weapons directly to Ukraine for the first time. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz at NATO headquarters in Brussels.
Investors will get new information this week about the economy and the job market. NPR's Scott Horsley reports forecasters think GDP grew at a healthy clip in the third quarter.
The Commerce Department reports this week on how much the U.S. economy grew in July, August, and September. We'll also learn how many jobs employers added in October. The monthly jobs report is expected to show some temporary weakness as a result of the Boeing strike and damage from hurricanes in the southeast. Quarter pounders are going back on the menu at hundreds of McDonald's restaurants after a brief suspension of sales due to an E. coli outbreak. Slivered onions on the burgers are the suspected culprit. The fast food chain is set to report quarterly earnings tomorrow. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you.
there a dash of Felix Mendelssohn's music, played by the Budapest Strings from Songs Without Words we listened to, Spring Song No. 6 in A Minor, on Kansas Public Radio. Good afternoon and welcome once again. I'm Jeff Watson, with more classical music for your Monday afternoon before All Things Considered rolls around at 3 p.m. Between now and then, one of Antonio Vivaldi's Sonatas for Cello, Michael Stern, ready to conduct the Kansas City Symphony as well, with the First Symphony by Samuel Barber. Quite a wonderful bit of American music, and we'll hear it in just a bit on KPR. The Orpheus Chamber Orchestra has music next by Igor Stravinsky, one of his most famous creations, made in the late 1930s, around 1937. Stravinsky had been commissioned by a well-to-do couple in Washington, D.C., one Robert and Mildred Bliss, who were celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary, and commissioned Stravinsky to provide something special for the occasion, an occasion which would be held at their estate Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C., and the following concerto has ever after been known as the Dumbarton Oaks Concerto. Play for us next by the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, here on KPR. Thank you. the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. And iconic music from Igor Stravinsky from the late 1930s, his Dumbarton Oaks Concerto, so named for the estate in Washington, D.C., where the music was first performed, here on Kansas Public Radio. It is 2:24. The Kansas City Symphony and conductor Michael Stern are going to join us in just about 10 minutes for the first symphony by Samuel Barber. Support for classical music on KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu. And the Lead Center, hosting comedian Lewis Black in Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, the final tour, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu. Hope you're enjoying the classical music here on a Monday afternoon. We have next cellist Christoph Kwan and members of the Academy of Ancient Music for a sonata by Antonio Vivaldi, Sonata for Cello No. 6, on Kansas Public Radio. Antonio Vivaldi, Cello Sonata No. 6 in B-flat major, played by cellist Christoph Kwan and members of the Academy of Kansas Public Radio. The time is 2:36, and at 3 o'clock, it'll be time for All Things Considered from NPR News. That's followed tonight by more classical music with Destiny, your host tonight, beginning at 7 p.m. And tonight, Destiny is calling this Moody Monday. Fittingly, the feature is Tchaikovsky's Pathétique Symphony, which premiered on this day in 1893. We've got that and more during Classical Music with Destiny at 7 p.m. and then from 8 to 9, Classics Live here on Kansas Public Radio. Something else to note coming up this weekend, there is going to be a sensational performance at the Kauffman Center of Mozart's Requiem on Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Kauffman Center and 2 p.m. Sunday with the KC Symphony and Chorus. Find out more about Mozart's Requiem performance and how to attend on any one of the three weekend performances. Find all that at kcsymphony.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy skies, breezy, a low of 69 degrees. Tomorrow's going to be a mostly sunny day with a high of 81, and it's expected to be especially windy with winds gusting up to 50 miles an hour. A wind advisory will be in effect for the KPR listening area for tomorrow. Tomorrow night, we should have lows in the mid-60s, as well as a chance of showers, and a good chance of showers by Wednesday. Michael Stern is here to conduct the Kansas City Symphony next on KPR, with music by Samuel Barber, which was completed in 1936, something that he dedicated to his friend and fellow composer Giancarlo Menotti, and somewhat modeled off the Seventh Symphony by Jean Sibelius. We'll hear Samuel Barber's Symphony No. 1. Michael Stern and the KC Symphony take it from here on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you.
from 1937. Symphony No. 1 by Samuel Barber, as played there by the Kansas City Symphony, conducted by Michael Stern, on KPR, where it's about 3 o'clock and about time for All Things Considered. I'm Jeff Watson. Thanks for joining me for classical music here on a Monday afternoon.
We are in the final stretch of this historic election season. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris are making their last big push before it all comes to a head tonight. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News. We will bring you the latest as the polls close and the vote totals roll in, with the context and analysis you need to stay informed.
Election Night coverage will, of course, be in a week and a day. Here at your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Cherry Street Youth, an after-school program for students in Chanute, now in a fundraising challenge to support the program, with 100% match doubling donations to the end of the year. Contributions welcome at cherrystreet.org.
How the inflammatory rhetoric at former President Trump's Madison Square Garden rally underscored his anti-immigrant message.
For Monday, October 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Vending machines that dole out clean needles and Narcan become the latest tool to fight overdose deaths.
People who come to these machines have already made their decision, or they're already using drugs. So I don't see how it's encouraging.
Also, the number of black men enrolled at historically black colleges and universities is the lowest it's been since 1976.
And one man ate 1,200 tacos to pick the best taco in Texas.
There's no one style. There's almost endless possibility.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The presidential candidates are crisscrossing swing states about a week before the election. Vice President Kamala Harris is ramping up her messaging to voters in Michigan today. She visited a semiconductor facility in Saginaw that received more than $300 million from the Bipartisan CHIPS Act signed last year by President Biden.
We have to constantly be on top of what is happening, what is current, and investing in the industries of the future, as well as honoring the traditions and the industries that have built up America's economy.
Former President Donald Trump is campaigning in Georgia today. He's taking part in a faith forum and will later hold a campaign event in Atlanta. Concern over election-related political violence remains high, but the nature of the threat has changed from what it was before the 2020 election, when organized extremist groups were much more active. NPR's Odette Youssef reports.
Data show that extremist groups have mobilized far less in 2024 than they did in 2020. Data from ACLED, the Armed Conflict Location and Events Data Project, show the activity has fallen by half. But ACLED's Kieran Doyle says the potential for political violence is still high.
Violence by individuals has been a huge concern this year, obviously with the two assassination attempts against Trump.
The Department of Homeland Security has similarly warned about individuals and small cells. A recent intelligence memo from DHS also noted that domestic extremists may be using encrypted and private group communication platforms, making the planning for acts of violence harder to detect. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
Health officials in Gaza say the death toll from Israel's war on Hamas has surpassed 43,000. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports the Israeli military continues to intensify its ground invasion in the northern part of the Strip.
The World Health Organization called the humanitarian crisis in North Gaza, quote, catastrophic, as Israeli strikes caused the last three functioning hospitals in the area to be largely inaccessible. The United Nations has predicted that an estimated 60,000 children under five will become acutely malnourished over the coming year. The UN also said that it was increasingly concerned with the manner in which the Israeli military is conducting its assault in North Gaza, which it said includes unlawful interference with humanitarian aid. The Israeli Israeli military says it continues to battle Hamas militants, which are regrouping all across Gaza, and denies it hinders access to aid. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Earlier today, Israel passed legislation that could paralyze efforts by the main UN agency delivering humanitarian aid in Gaza. This is NPR News in Washington. McDonald's says it will resume selling Quarter Pounders this week. The fast food chain says an investigation has ruled out beef patties as the source of a recent outbreak of E. coli. The FDA continues to investigate the source and believes it's linked to fresh onions from a supplier in California. The outbreak has left one person dead and sickened 75 in more than a dozen states. More than a third of the world's tree species are at risk of extinction. That's according to a new assessment. NPR's Nathan Rott reports that's bad for a lot of reasons.
Trees provide the planet with breathable air. They help store planet-warming carbon. They provide habitat for countless other plant, animal, and fungi species. They provide shade. But according to new findings from the International Union for Conservation of Nature Red List, the world's leading scientific authority on threatened species, 38% of the world's tree species are now threatened with extinction. Agriculture, logging, and urbanization are the biggest drivers of tree decline. Climate change is up there, too. The findings were announced at the ongoing United Nations Convention on Biodiversity, where world leaders are striving to correct course. But progress has been slow. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
A London-based cheese manufacturer has reported nearly $400,000 in high-quality cheddar cheese stolen. The company says it delivered nearly 1,000 wheels of the cheddar to an alleged fraudster posing as a wholesale distributor. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Z's Divine Espresso, offering organic coffees via drive-thru windows and inside at 1800 East 23rd Street and 2351 West 31st in Lawrence. CoffeeInLawrence.com.
It's 85 degrees in Emporia, 82 on the KU campus in Lawrence. The time is 3:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. On Sunday afternoon, to kick off the last full week of the 2024 presidential campaign, thousands of people lined up under a screen several stories high with the image of former President Donald Trump. They were waiting outside New York's Madison Square Garden, where Trump was holding a campaign rally. It was a homecoming of sorts for the man who's portrayed himself as the quintessential New Yorker.
I'm thrilled to be back in the city I love, and thousands of proud, hardworking American patriots, you're with me. We're all.
The headliner took the stage 2 hours after he was scheduled to. And before that, more than two dozen others spoke. Many leaned into racist, misogynistic, and vulgar rhetoric, like comedian Tony Hinchcliffe.
I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
There was intense backlash, and a Trump campaign advisor later put out a statement distancing the former president from Hinchcliffe's remarks. But Hinchcliffe wasn't the only speaker who used incendiary language during the rally Sunday night. Trump's childhood friend David Rem had this to say about Vice President Kamala Harris.
In fact, she is the devil, whoever screamed that out.
And Stephen Miller, a policy advisor in the Trump White House and current senior campaign advisor, underscored the former president's anti-immigrant message.
America is for Americans and Americans only.
Other speakers included Elon Musk, Hulk Hogan, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, and Phil McGraw, better known as Dr. Phil. Finally, more than 4 hours into the program, Trump took the stage and spoke for another 78 minutes, repeating many of the themes his warm-up acts had touched on.
On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history to get the criminals out. We will get critical race theory and transgender insanity the hell out of our schools. Kamala Harris is a train wreck who has destroyed everything in her path. To make her president would be a gamble with the lives of millions and millions of people.
Well, NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben was at that rally last night, and she's with us now. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Ari.
That joke about Puerto Rico, where the comedian called it a floating island of garbage, is getting the most backlash today. What's the response been?
Well, the fallout was immediate. Before the rally was even over, you had New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and vice presidential nominee Tim Walz, who were doing an online event for the Harris campaign already. They played that clip and reacted with disgust as they heard it. Not only that, but pretty immediately, the Harris campaign itself quickly retweeted a clip. But the backlash has not at all been only from Democrats. Republican politicians, including Florida Senator Rick Scott and Congressman Carlos Jimenez, posted on X last night also criticizing that joke. And the Trump campaign, as you mentioned, got the message. In a statement late last night, the campaign senior advisor Danielle Alvarez said, quote, "This joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign."
That one line has gotten the most attention, but the rally as a whole has received a lot of criticism. You were there for those many hours. What stood out to you about it?
Well, a lot stood out. I mean, several speakers, as you said again, made racist, misogynistic, and just inflammatory remarks, which might even be putting it mildly. I mean, Hinchcliffe made a joke about football player Travis Kelce killing his girlfriend, Taylor Swift. Investor Grant Cardone was particularly crude in talking about Harris.
She's a fake. I'm not here to invalidate her. She's a fake, a fraud. She's a pretender. Her and her pimp handlers will destroy our country.
And then conservative commentator Tucker Carlson insulted Kamala Harris's mixed race heritage as well as her intelligence. Here he was.
It's going to be pretty hard to look at us and say, you know what? Kamala Harris, she got 85 million votes because she's just so impressive. As the first Samoan Malaysian low IQ former California prosecutor ever to be elected president, it was just a groundswell of popular support.
And even beyond his insults, Carlson referenced the racist great replacement theory, saying in his speech that Democrats want to, quote, replace Americans with, as he put it, people who would be reliable voters.
You have covered Trump's campaign all year. Do you expect it to be affected by any of this?
You know, what's been remarkable in this absolutely wild election year is that almost nothing has shifted the polls, short of the Democrats swapping candidates. Besides that, it's been remarkably stable. Assassination attempts, Trump saying immigrants are vermin or poisoning the blood of the nation, Trump's generals calling him fascist. Nothing seems to budge anything. So in that light, I don't know if even this kind of a night is going to swing anything. But as we keep saying, this is a close race. It'll be decided in a handful of states. So it doesn't take that big of a swing to have a decisive impact. But one really remarkable thing is that the Trump campaign is very clearly taking the response to this rally seriously in that they responded and said they don't agree with that joke about Puerto Ricans.
And why is that significant?
Well, because the campaign rarely disavows support, and they certainly don't backtrack on offensive rhetoric, at least very rarely do they. I mean, often when Trump's opponents criticize him, his supporters see that as a good thing. For example, ahead of last night's rally, opponents, including Hillary Clinton, compared this rally to a Nazi rally that was held at Madison Square Garden in 1939. So then last night, speakers joked about that. Here's Terry Bollea, who people might better know as Hulk Hogan.
I don't see no stinking Nazis in here. I don't see no stinking domestic terrorists in here.
I mean, think about all the things Trump doesn't back down from. A couple weeks ago, he called Democrats the enemy from within and suggested he'd use the military on them. And, well, last night, he doubled down on that once again, saying, yes, they are the enemy from within. So maybe in the next few days he could turn down the temperature, but also he has shown so clearly that that's not something he likes to do.
That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, whether you like them folded in a corn or flour tortilla with green salsa or red, tacos are one of the most iconic foods in Texas. Jose Relat traveled all over the state, that's 14,000 miles, eating more than 1,200 tacos along the way to come up with Texas Monthly's new list, the 50 best tacos in Texas. Relat is Texas Monthly's taco editor, a dream job, am I right? And he's here to talk about how the state's iconic food is evolving in 2024. Welcome back to NPR.
Thank you.
So great to have you. And before we begin, you wanted me to note that you have a speech impediment, yeah?
Yes.
All right. Well, let's dig into your rankings here. Can you tell me about the taco that took first place?
Yeah. So, Annalise Taqueria's Chile Relleno Taco is deceptively simple looking. Mm. It's a corn tortilla with an opened green chili, cheese, and then fajita. But when you bite into it, everything comes together, from the fragrant, wonderfully chewy corn tortilla to the salty cheese, the spice of the chili and the smoky beef. It's just wild that something like that could even exist.
Oh, my God.
And it's also fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be a little sense of fun in tacos, right?
Oh, absolutely. Tell me what was fun about this chile relleno taco.
Well, it's pretty looking. Uh-huh. It's creative in that it's deconstructed. And also to think that in flour-dominating South Texas, that there's this bastion of nixtamalized corn tortillas is wild. Now, for those who don't know, nixtamalization is basically the process that the Aztecs used to soak corn in an alkaline solution that releases all the nutrients that are inside corn kernels, therefore making it a kind of superfood.
So cool. Well, you wrote that throughout the state, you found tacos that weren't just only simple, but were also pushing culinary boundaries, right? Like there was a taco you tasted at El Paso's Taqueria El Tiger, topped with a smoky kimchi salsa. Tell me about that taco.
Yes. So that is the tripe and trembloso taco, again, on a nixtamalized corn tortilla. Now, tripe and squishily wiggly chicharron are not uncommon tacos, right?
Yeah.
But the fact that he uses onions and this salsa morita soaked kimchi just takes it over the top. And it's just always a joy.
You make it sound like a joy.
Yeah, right?
Also, tripe brings me back to childhood. I mean, we Asians, we love all parts of the pig.
So do us Latinos, right?
Yeah. All right, so after you chomped your way through 1,200 different tacos, Jose, what did this journey teach you about how the taco tradition is evolving in Texas?
It's clear to me that the taco will do what the taco will do.
Mm.
That it is not willing to be confined to a box. There's absolutely no boundary that it can't overcome.
I love that idea. That is Texas Monthly's taco editor, Jose Relat. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City. Always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Stoneback Appliance in Lawrence, locally owned with real people that answer your call, not a machine. Details and information at stonebackappliance.com, where we've got your back.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, an update of news headlines, of course. Then we are going to learn more about a new anthology of spooky stories. Two local authors are featured there. Kay McIntyre spoke with them, and we will hear about it coming up in the next 30 minutes. Also, of course, news headlines and details on what is going on with the lawsuit in Pennsylvania over mail-in ballot issues. That is all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Blue Collar Press has been helping businesses, musicians, and artists, big and small, turn ideas into promotional merchandise for 20 years. More information at bluecollarpress.com.
Quite a bit of weather, I don't even know how to describe it. Look, we have a red flag warning in effect until 8 o'clock tonight for Clay, Cloud, Dickinson, Geary, Morris, Ottawa, and Riley counties. Also for Chase, Greenwood, Wilson, and Woodson counties, could see gusty winds up to 50 miles per hour further south that you go. We will have wind advisories in effect tomorrow virtually all day for virtually all of the KPR listening area. We have a wind advisory till 7 o'clock tonight for Morris, Waubonsie, Lyon, Osage, Coffee, and Anderson counties. Be aware, this is not a good day to be out driving around.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Vending machines are one of the newest tools in the fight to reduce overdose deaths in the U.S. Instead of potato chips and candy, these machines dispense clean syringes, pipes for smoking crack or meth, Narcan, and more. From member station WBUR, Martha Biebinger reports.
This machine, painted with a spray of colorful triangles, sits at the entrance to an office that hands out sterile drug use supplies. But Berkshire Harm Reduction, in the small, quaint city of North Adams, Massachusetts, is only open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m.
So if they're closed, I got this.
A man named Brian pats the machine. Before it arrived in August, Brian was taking risks he knew he shouldn't. We're only using Brian's first name because he buys and uses illegal drugs.
I don't shoot up that much, but someone should give me something. And if it's late at night, I don't want to use their needle, but I really want to do this, you know?
So Brian would try to sterilize a used needle to avoid getting hepatitis C or HIV. Now, on nights and weekends, Brian can tap a code into the vending machine for free sterile needles and other items aimed at reducing the harm of drug use. Today, Brian can check for fentanyl in the crack he smokes.
So I want to get the fentanyl test strips, so I'll type in 100 and press pound. I think that's what that is.
There's plenty of Narcan in the machine in case any of Brian's buddies needs to reverse an overdose. A study in the journal Annals of Medicine suggests Narcan in vending machines reduced overdose deaths in southern Nevada by 15% in 1 year. In Cincinnati, analysts say 24/7 access to supplies helps slow the spread of HIV. Sarah Whaley at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health argues the benefits of vending machines outweigh the dangers. She says the machines do not lead to more needles littering the ground or more drug use nearby.
So no increase in crime rates, no increases in loitering, none of, I think, the general concerns that people have.
Critics also argue that giving people needles or pipes enables or encourages drug use. Chief John Batiste, who co-chairs the Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Committee for the International Association of Chiefs of Police, doesn't buy it.
People who come to these machines have already made their decision, or they're already using drugs. So I don't see how it's encouraging.
What's in a harm reduction vending machine varies. Narcan and condoms are common. Pipes and syringes are not. They're banned as drug paraphernalia in 11 states. Chief Batiste does not take a position on what to offer, but he supports the vending machine option.
we're in a sad state of affairs as a country. I mean, we are losing thousands upon thousands of lives. So for creativity and thinking outside the norm, it has to be on the table.
The machines allow clients to access supplies after hours, but they do not provide counseling or support. So Sarah DeJesus at Berkshire Harm Reduction turns the machine off when the office is open.
And they have to come in and reconnect with us so that we're talking about what substances they're using, what supplies they're getting, and just overall how they're doing.
Federal grants and money from opioid settlements are helping boost machine sales. The company that makes the one in North Adams says it has sold hundreds across 35 states. Finding locations can be tough. Massachusetts bought 14 machines last year and has only placed one so far. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in North Adams, Massachusetts.
The destruction that Hurricane Helene left behind in North Carolina's western mountains has overshadowed another climate-related disaster at the other end of the state. Rising sea levels there are causing houses to fall into the ocean at an accelerating pace. It's a slow-moving disaster with implications for coastal communities around the country. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports on North Carolina's Outer Banks.
Rodanthe is among more than half a dozen communities scattered along the 70-mile-long Cape Hatteras National Seashore. Houses here are built on pilings high above the sand, but where the seashore's superintendent, Dave Halleck, was standing on a recent day, they're no longer out of reach of the Atlantic.
Before those three houses collapsed, we had a house collapse here on August 16th. So it's been four houses just within the last couple of months.
Bringing the total to 10 collapsed houses in the tiny village in the past 4 years. And more are poised to fall in any time because the beach is washing away. That erosion has been turbocharged by rising sea levels fueled by human-caused climate change. Halleck pointed to one house now at sea, totally surrounded by water. Nearby, other houses have waves wash under them at high tide. More and more, the problem on the minds of officials like Halleck isn't how to save such houses, it's how to remove them before they collapse into the sea and leave leaking septic systems and scattered debris for miles down the beach.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Halleck's uniform had drawn the attention of Tim and Heather Manbevers, late-season tourists from Ohio visiting Nag's Head about 30 miles north. They'd driven down just to see the place where houses are falling in. Tim Manbevers gestured at the house surrounded by water and asked the question a lot of people have.
I just wonder why they've just let them go into the ocean.
Because it's expensive to tear them down.
Really?
I'm guessing most of them would rather wait for it to collapse and then they would be able to get some reimbursement from their insurance company.
Otherwise, the owners may have to pay out of their own pocket for tearing down a house before it falls. Rodanthe isn't the only place where key buffers of dune and beach have been eaten away by erosion. More than 750 homes along North Carolina's coast are now considered threatened, according to a report released in August by the state and the National Park Service.
So we're looking at, you know, several hundred structures that could be put at risk due to a major storm or major erosion event that could happen pretty much any time.
Tancred Miller is director of the State Division of Coastal Management, and like Halleck, was part of the group that developed the report. It made recommendations for ways the local, state, and federal governments could remove houses before they fall, but there's little funding for any of it.
Bottom line is there really is no silver bullet.
The problem looms in other states, too, says Rob Young, director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University.
The homes that are being lost in Rodanthe are a harbinger for things to come on shorelines across the East Coast and the Gulf Coast of the United States of America.
Those regions are especially vulnerable to climate-driven sea level rise. He says the nation is far from coming to terms with the idea that so many structures will have to come down, let alone coming up with long-term plans and funding for what he calls a managed retreat from the sea.
We cannot hold every shoreline in place for forever. You know, at the moment, we are almost literally trying to build one beach from Saco, Maine to Padre Island, Texas, by pumping sand and doing what we call beach nourishment projects.
Young says the wisest course in Rodanthe may be to find a way to buy out the most threatened homes, something the county is trying to do now, while working to put systemic fixes in place like those recommended in the report.
What we're learning from Rodanthe is that we don't have a great approach in place for how we can keep these homes from toppling into the sea.
But whether we manage that retreat from the water or let it happen chaotically on its own, it will happen. The sea, he says, is coming. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Rodanthe, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
Supporters of Vice President Harris are aiming to win part of a Republican constituency, white evangelical voters.
To win some of these swing states, we don't have to win everybody. We just have to win enough to win this election and protect our Constitution.
The Evangelical Vote on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations, 5 to 9 a.m. It is Morning Edition on KPR. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering the New York Times and Washington Post online, Ancestry.com, and more, all available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
News headlines are up next. Partly cloudy skies this evening, then clearing, very breezy, lows in the upper 60s. I'll have the details on red flag warnings and wind advisories coming up shortly here on KPR. It's 3:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, we look at the dropping enrollment of black men at historically black colleges and universities.
You attend an HBCU for an education and not a degree. And as an assistant provost, that's not a popular thing to say.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. With just over a week to go before Election Day, President Biden cast his vote today near his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware. Here's NPR's Mara Liasson.
The president voted early, like millions of Americans have this year. He waited in line at the polling place with Democratic Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, who is running to represent Delaware in the Senate, as Biden once did. Biden cast his vote for Vice President Kamala Harris. Asked whether the moment was bittersweet since Biden had decided to abandon his own bid for re-election, he responded, "This is just sweet." Biden said he was confident that Vice President Harris would win. 4 years ago, Biden cast his vote in a race that he won with the most votes ever cast for a U.S. presidential candidate. Harris and Donald Trump are locked in a close race for the White House, and in the final days, both candidates are crisscrossing the seven battleground states that will decide the election. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The humanitarian crisis in Gaza is worsening, and Israel is under increased U.S. pressure to ramp up aid. Providing that much-needed assistance, though, is now at risk after Israeli lawmakers passed a measure today restricting the UN agency that distributes food and medicine from operating on Israeli soil. The vote comes after Israeli forces carried out airstrikes on Iran over the weekend in retaliation for missile strikes on Tel Aviv earlier this month. Sanam Vakil is the director of the Middle East program at the London-based think tank Chatham House.
We've been waiting for this counterstrike from Israel to Iran for over 3.5 weeks, and certainly this strike has been relatively targeted. The Supreme Leader of Iran is vowing some sort of response, but I don't expect that to come right now with over a week to go to the U.S. election.
On Wall Street, stocks finished higher today. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Opponents of the death penalty in Kansas were in court today to testify in the first of many hearings on capital punishment. National legal groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, are challenging the death penalty in Wyandotte County District Court. They say it's racially discriminatory. Alex Valdez, a staff attorney for the ACLU, says black people are struck from juries at higher rates because they are more likely to oppose the death penalty.
Yes, it's horrible that racism infects at every single level, but it's unimaginably wrong that it could lead to someone's death.
at the hands of the state.
Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree said the challenge is premature because the defendant in the case being cited has not yet been sentenced. A survey released today by the Docking Institute at Forte State University finds that support for Medicaid expansion remains high in Kansas. The annual Kansas Speaks survey found that 72% of Kansans support expanding Medicaid and 76% think doing so would help rural hospitals remain in business. That support is actually up slightly from last year. Democratic Governor Laura Kelly has tried for years to expand Medicaid, but the Republican supermajority in the Kansas legislature has blocked the policy. Alexandra Middlewood is a political science professor at Wichita State University. She says the response highlights how voters' beliefs on key policy issues do not always align with their voting behavior.
Most of the devices would isolate.
We will have that audio for you coming up in our next hour. Catcher Salvador Perez became the first member of the Kansas City Royals to be awarded the Roberto Clemente Award in recognition of humanitarian work. Greg Eklund has that story.
Salvador Perez has become well known for his outgoing personality and his easy engagement with fans and young people. Early this summer, he joined in with some neighborhood kids playing baseball and had ended up going viral on social media. He's been an active participant in Kansas City's Urban Youth Academy, but he's also the owner of a youth baseball league in his Venezuelan hometown of Valencia. Other causes he's supported have been in fundraising and awareness for ALS, cancer, and the families of fallen or wounded police officers. The prestigious Clemente Award caps off a multitude of honors for Perez's 13th season with the Royals, including his 9th appearance as a member of the American League All-Star team. I'm Greg Eklund.
You're listening to KPR. It's 3:35.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. In the crucial battleground state of Pennsylvania, voters are sending in their ballots by mail. Right now, there are several ongoing lawsuits across the state over whose mail-in ballots must be counted. And the final outcome of these cases could help determine who wins Pennsylvania's electoral votes, which could really matter with polls suggesting we are in for a tight presidential race. NPR voting rights correspondent Hansi Lo Wong has been tracking this and is here now. Hi, Hansi.
Hi, Mary Louise.
What is the focus of these lawsuits?
They're all focused on what to do when a mail-in voter in Pennsylvania returns an absentee ballot on time but doesn't follow other rules for getting their vote counted.
Okay, before we get into the details, who is bringing these lawsuits?
Well, it's been voting rights groups, and they're arguing that sometimes voters make mistakes, and those who do should not have their ballots rejected. But Republican groups have been pushing back, and generally they're arguing in the court that the state's election rules are the rules, and they should be followed exactly. You know, what's interesting is that all of these legal questions could be resolved by state lawmakers. In fact, a bipartisan advisory board recommended changes to Pennsylvania's election law to, quote, eliminate confusion and litigation. But there's been partisan gridlock in Pennsylvania, so voters in the state really have to pay close attention to all the required steps for mail-in voting.
Okay, they have to do each step exactly as it has been laid out. What are the steps?
If you are voting by mail in Pennsylvania, you have to first seal your completed ballot inside a yellow-colored secrecy envelope and put that yellow envelope inside an outer return envelope. And before you return it, you have to add your signature on that return envelope and handwrite the current date under your signature.
Go back to one of the things you just said about that, the yellow secrecy envelopes, because mm-hmm. those have been the focus of some of this litigation.
Yeah, election officials have been calling ballots that come without those secrecy envelopes naked ballots. And if you're missing that yellow secrecy envelope, your ballot is not supposed to be counted. But there's a lawsuit over whether Pennsylvania voters whose naked ballots are rejected can cast provisional ballots in person on Election Day. And this month, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, yes, those provisional ballots should be counted. But this afternoon, the Republican National Committee asked the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in.
Okay, I got it. And then what about that other step you mentioned, ballots in return envelopes, but that maybe are missing the current date, handwritten by the voter?
Right. Some call these undated and misdated ballots. And to be clear, we're talking about ballots that arrive on time. But the issue is about this artifact of Pennsylvania's election rules that require the voter to handwrite the current date on that outer return envelope. And for now, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ruled these undated or misdated ballots should not be counted. But that may not be the final word before Election Day. I'm watching a case out of Philadelphia that's working its way up the state courts.
Okay, so we're talking about what's happening in Pennsylvania. What should absentee voters in other states be keeping in mind as they're maybe looking at mail-in ballots and we're getting step-by-step closer to Election Day?
You know, mail-in voters in every state should take real care when they're returning their ballots. We often see thousands of ballots rejected in a state's election because of mistakes. And I should point out, tomorrow is the Postal Service's suggested deadline for returning your ballot if it arrives, so it arrives by Election Day. And after that, absentee voters may want to consider returning their ballot in person at their county election office or at a drop box if there's one nearby.
And PR's Hansila Wong, thank you.
You're welcome.
The RLC straddles the border of the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. It was once one of the world's largest lakes, but after years of being drained to irrigate crops, it shriveled and nearly disappeared. In a last-ditch effort, Kazakhstan tried to stop the rapid drain of the sea's dwindling waters by building a massive dam. NPR's Above the Fray fellow Valerie Kipnis reports from the shores of the RLC in Kazakhstan.
The village of Tostubek was nearly desolate for 30 years. Omer Serik Ibrahimov grew up without knowing the sea. He only heard about it in his father's stories.
I was born in 1993, and when I was born, the sea was already gone.
As a boy, Ibrahimov played in abandoned boats scattered along a dried-up seabed. When the dam was built, Ibrahimov was 10. And as the water returned, his father taught him how to fish.
So in 1-2 years after building the dam, the water salinity dropped down.
These days, Ibrahimov is one of dozens of fishermen in Tostubek, able to make a living off fishing in what's come to be known, since it's split in two, as the Northern Aral Sea. Out on the blue water, it's hard to imagine the sea was ever at risk of drying up. Wearing thick rubber gloves, fishermen grab breams, asp, and catfish out of fishing nets bobbing in the salty water. They say they can make a decent living now, but worry about how long this will all last.
And the last 2 years, the sea receded about 200 meters from the coastline. It's becoming lower and lower, and I think that it's the main reason why we have less fish now in the Aral Sea, because there is less water.
There are a number of reasons for this. The most obvious being that the dam that contains the Northern Aral Sea is too low, so water spills over it and evaporates. And then there's the river, the Sir Daria, one of two rivers which feeds the Aral Sea. Medieval Islamic texts refer to it as one of the four rivers of paradise. There are songs and stories written about it, but over the years its levels have been slowly dropping. An 8-hour drive through rice plantations upstream, and you can see why. We arrive in the city of Kizlurda. It's in the region closest to the Aral Sea, and it produces nearly all of the country's rice, a food staple in Kazakhstan.
So we are currently at where the Sir Daria River enters the region of Kizlurda, and it goes through this sort of dam-like structure that holds back some of it and diverts the rest to go towards these canals that are, it's going to feed the rice plantations. And what's left for the actual river to flow to the Aral Sea, it's minimal.
In some parts, the river levels are so low that small islands of sand appear in the middle. And it's not all the rice industry to blame. It's the way that water is managed and used that's inefficient.
A lot of water is lost in the infrastructure, the big long irrigation canals. Some of them are not lined, some are earthen.
Bolat Bekinyaz is the Vice Minister of Water Resources and Irrigation for all of Kazakhstan. He's dedicated his life to studying the RLC.
In the near future, we will gradually reduce water consumption.
But the situation is urgent. The shrinking of the RLC has itself changed the regional climate.
If we don't adapt, we can lose both rivers, so we must adapt. We must.
Nowhere is this urgency to adapt felt more than the fishing village of Tostubek, right at the end of the river's course. As Ibrahimov pulls out his daily catch, he says his only dream now is for the sea to be restored for good.
If it will continue shrinking or there will be less water or salty, and if you lose fish in the RLC, that will be the biggest problem, tragedy for the villagers.
For the villagers, the farmers, the people of Kazakhstan, and the hopes of fighting climate change in the region. For NPR News, this is Valerie Kipnis reporting from Aralsk in Kazakhstan.
And you're listening to All Things Considered.
You're listening to NPR on KPR, Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Just in time for Halloween, a cross-country anthology of spooky stories includes a visit to a Kansas landmark. The Haunted States of America features a story from each state. William Mockrey of Lawrence represents Kansas with his short story, Midnight in the Garden of Eden, which he discussed with KPR's Kay McIntyre.
It had to be about a local legend or a local landmark from your state. And I didn't really know a whole lot of legends or stories about cryptids from Kansas. And I did some research on the internet. Nothing that I was seeing was really speaking to me. And suddenly it occurred to me, well, one of my favorite places in the state of Kansas is the Garden of Eden in the town of Lucas. And I said, that would be the perfect setting for a story. And as soon as that idea popped in my head, I said, I've got it. This is my idea. And I went with it.
And they're spooky stories, but they're not super scary.
Yeah, nobody's going to be traumatized by these stories. But they are fun, and I think they're delightfully scary. Something I think would be appropriate for young readers and also for adults, too. I think adults would enjoy these as well.
Can I have you read from Midnight in the Garden of Eden?
Certainly. I was 6 when I saw Samuel Dinsmore. Mom lifted me up in her arms as the tour guide shone a flashlight on his glass-topped casket. Every hair of his long bristly beard was perfectly preserved, but his sunken face was rotting away, shriveled, covered in white, crackling mold. I wriggled out of Mom's arms and screamed my way out of the concrete tomb. I begged her never to take me back. But in Lucas, Kansas, you can never really escape the Garden of Eden. Every visitor to our prairie town stops to see the strange log cabin. Samuel Dinsmore built it from logs of limestone, not wood. He sculpted trees out of concrete, tall as telephone poles, and planted them in his front yard. He filled the branches with concrete people, Bible characters, common American folk, even animals. Tourists flocked from near and far for a peek at the home he called the Garden of Eden, and he gladly showed them around. Now, long after his death, he's still there, in a concrete tomb in the backyard. Before he died, he wrote that on some dark night in the future, he hoped to slip out of his mausoleum and look around. For years, the memory of his face haunted me. Anytime I walked down Kansas Avenue, I crossed to the other side of the street. I looked away, but the concrete people and the concrete trees never did. The back of my neck would tingle, as though they were watching me. All right, we're going to jump ahead in the story just a little bit. The gate creaked eerily. Above my head, words seemed to whisper in the wind. It sounded like, "He's here! He's here!" But the wind stopped, and so did the voices. The door to the concrete tomb was wide open. "Rocky?" I gulped back my dread. I wouldn't take so much as a peek at the decaying corpse. I would just run inside, grab my dog, and hurry back home. The tomb was silent, only a small sliver of lamplight. No trace of Rocky. I turned around to leave, but something drew me back. Morbid curiosity pulled at me. I stepped up to the glass. The coffin was empty.
A That was William Mockery reading Midnight in the Garden of Eden. The short story is the Kansas entry in a new anthology, The Haunted States of America. Two local authors are actually featured in The Haunted States of America. Dr. Giselle Anatole is the director of the Hall Center for the Humanities at the University of Kansas, and her story, The Ghost Jockey, represents the state of Pennsylvania. You can hear her conversation with Kay McIntyre, as well as a longer version of Kay's conversation with William Mockery, at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, committed to a healthier future for all Kansans with health care coverage for businesses and their employees. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business.
It's your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence as well. We are always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Assistive Technology for Kansans, providing people with disabilities and health conditions access to technology to live, work, and play safely. More information at atk.ku.edu.
Hope you'll stay tuned coming up in our next half hour when Hurricane Helene took out a factory making 60% of the country's IV fluids. It caused shortages that have led to canceled surgeries nationwide. A look at the effects and the prospects for improvement coming right up here on KPR. Partly cloudy skies this evening, then clearing, breezy, lows in the upper 60s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and windy, highs in the lower 80s. A wind advisory tomorrow for pretty much the entire KPR listening area. We could see winds gusting up to 55 miles per hour in some areas. Be cautious. We do still have high fire danger throughout the region as well. It's 10 minutes before 4.
From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The absolute number of black men enrolled at historically black colleges and universities is the lowest it's been since 1976. That's according to recent analysis from the American Institute for Boys and Men, which crunched data from the Department of Education. In fact, black men now currently account for only 26% of the students at HBCUs. Back in 1976, that figure was 38%. Calvin Hadley is invested in closing this gap. He's assistant provost for academic partnerships and student engagement at Howard University, and he is here in the studio with me now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by talking about Howard, which, of course, is one of the foremost HBCUs in this country, a long, long list that I cannot recite of incredible alumni, including Vice President Kamala Harris. Let's start there. Are you seeing this decline among black male students where you are there at Howard, just down the road from us?
I am. I'm a Howard alum. And so I remember as a student, the numbers were also pretty stark at that time. I think we were around 33% to 34% when I was a student between 2004 and 2008. Now, as you announced in your introduction, Howard University is around 25% male total. And I think a recent statistic said around 19% black male. And so that is felt on campus. That is felt, I think, in our social clubs. It's felt on the yard. And I think many of our male students have commented that in some of their classes, they're the only male in their class.
So I will just say I did not attend an HBCU. I attended a PWI, a predominantly white institution. But I have so many friends and family members who attended HBCUs. They talk to me about what that experience has meant to them, not just while they're on campus, but when they go out into their professional lives, they stay connected to the HBCU experience. So I just want to ask you, when there are fewer black men on campus, what does that mean? What do we lose when those black men are not as robust a presence on campuses like yours?
By the time students actually come to college, we're dealing with the males that have actually transcended what we call the belief gap. This gap in between what students can actually achieve and what their professors, teachers, counselors believe they can achieve. For black males, that gap is the largest. When they get into the campus experiences is significantly impacted by the imbalance, right? At every educational institution, we want a diversity of experience. And so when you don't have as many males in a classroom, that diversity of experience is significantly impacted. I think we're dealing with some really unique statistics right now. black males, as we will dive deeper into this in a moment, are graduating at a much lower rate than black females.
And that's across all colleges.
Across all colleges, not just HBCUs. Right. This is not an HBCU problem. This is not a PWI problem. This is an American education problem.
The study that we've been talking about, it notes that since 2010, as you point out, black male enrollment has gone down across all colleges. And it also points out that HBCU enrollment has also decreased on the whole, but the decline of black male enrollment at HBCUs outpaces those trends, if only slightly. Can you just explain to me how you understand that gap?
So I want to take a small step back. There are a number of really important things that happened between 2012 and 2022. One of those was the election of President Donald Trump. Another was the murder of George Floyd. I think when those things happen in the United States of America, the HBCU experience can now become a much more attractive proposition. You notice a significant increase in those male applications. While we received 9,700 male applications in 2022-23, we received upwards of 30,000 female applications. Black women are ripping it up. All the statistics show from high school to college to college graduation that the black woman, the black female, is successful today and the trajectory is going straight up. Unfortunately, when you look at the black male, the exact opposite is the case. What we now will have imbalance in the community that has a significant impact on our ability to create whole families. I think on the ability for us to ensure that our generations after us have additional success and to really to have additional mobility.
I want to end on this. You are a product of Howard University. As you point out, you now work for the university and you're raising two young black boys. What's your pitch for why a young black man who might be hearing our conversation in 2024 should choose to attend an HBCU? Why should they?
You attend an HBCU for an education and not a degree. And as an assistant provost, that's not a popular thing to say. The education that you receive in an HBCU transcends the classroom experience. The education exists in between the lines of the pages. HBCUs are created to instill you with the belief that you can be even larger than you can dream, with the sense that I am enough. I can be successful academically, but my world is not simply academics. I can be enough and I can contribute to this society and this space. And so when I'm talking to that young man in 2024, come because we need you. Come because you're important. Come because without you, our community is hurt.
Calvin Hadley, Assistant Provost at Howard University. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a new album out by the Spanish artist Jude Line. It's called Bodiria, and it melds the traditional music of southern Spain with modern electronic production. One song in particular traces the singer's family history, as NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports.
When you first hear one of Jude Line's songs, it can transport you back in time. The 21-year-old grew up in Caños de Meca, south of Spain. Her music is rooted in the flamenco and Arabic traditions of Andalusia. But there are other rhythms that are part of her sound and lineage too, like Venezuelan folklore.
A lot of my family moved there during the civil war in Spain.
Jude Line's dad was born in Madrid, but
he was raised in Venezuela, so he feels Venezuelan.
She honored that on her debut album with this song, Joropo.
So Joropo is a Venezuelan genre, I think Colombian too. Bueno, es música llanera.
It's often led by the bandola and cuatro venezolano, a four-string instrument that Jude Line's dad taught her to play when she was young.
So I called him and I told him, like, hey, papa, quiero hacer este joropo. He was so excited about going to the studio and being with me and playing the cuatro venezolano. It was really beautiful to share time with my dad in that way and create this with him.
But the song is not a straightforward joropo. There's also Spanish guitar, thumping percussion, flutes.
At the end, I was like so happy because it has these flamenco vibes, Venezuelan vibes. It's a crazy mix of all the stuff.
Jude Line says this song reflects the changing generations of her family. Her dad eventually moved back to Spain, where he raised her. But she says that tide of migration across the Atlantic and back, taking one culture, combining it with a new one, is still part of her family's DNA, and it's embedded in her music.
Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Cuatro angelitos que a mí, ay, que a mí me la guardan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. From Organic Valley, a dairy cooperative of small organic family farms that is dedicated to protecting the land and all the plants and animals that live there. Learn more about Organic Valley at ov.coop. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Brat summer might be over, but at Morning Edition from NPR News, we're always here to help you understand the vibe of the season. Oh, and the news, too. Join us every weekday.
Join us tomorrow morning, beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Your local host will be Jay Schaefer. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Wind advisories in effect for a portion of the KPR listening area till 7.
This shortage is still touching nearly every hospital in the country.
Hurricane Helene damaged a crucial factory making IV fluids. Weeks later, hospitals are still scrambling to deal with the shortage.
For Monday, October 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump campaign is trying to distance itself from a speaker who made fun of Puerto Rico.
This comedian, he actually talked about people who were native-born and they can vote and they are Americans. So this is very delicate for the Trump campaign.
Later, Mexico City celebrates St. Jude, patron saint of lost causes.
Plus, baseball returns to a field once used by Japanese Americans incarcerated in Southern California during World War II.
A lot of things that sustained the community while they were in the camp was baseball. It was the thing that reminded them that they were still American.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. In the final week of the 2024 presidential race, Democrat Kamala Harris is making campaign stops in Michigan today. Speaking at a semiconductor plant in Saginaw County, Harris said her administration would both reassess federal jobs requiring a college degree and make the U.S. even more preeminent in terms of technological innovation.
What you are doing here on the ground makes real that investing in American industries and investing in American workers can happen at the same time. There doesn't have to be a tension between the two. That doing this work will also be about understanding, look, we got to win the competition for the 21st century. We're not going to have China beat us in the competition for the 21st century.
The facility Harris toured, Hemlock Semiconductor, recently received a $325 million federal grant for a new factory. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz is in Wisconsin today. Former President Donald Trump is campaigning in Atlanta, fresh off the latest controversy surrounding his campaign. At a rally last night at Madison Square Garden, a comedian made racist and offensive comments, Tony Hinchcliffe referring to Puerto Rico as, quote, a floating island of garbage. Trump is in Atlanta, Georgia tonight and is set to speak to reporters tomorrow at Mar-a-Lago. Iran has executed an Iranian-German journalist and software engineer for terrorism, a charge his family strongly denies. As NPR's Jackie Northam explains, the execution came 2 days after Israel launched retaliatory strikes on Iran.
In 2020, Iranian security forces kidnapped Jamshid Shammad as he was traveling through Dubai. He was brought back to Iran and convicted for allegedly taking part in the 2008 bombing of a mosque and for being a leader of a group aiming to topple Iran's government. At the time, the 68-year-old was a permanent resident of the U.S. and living in California. Iran's judiciary website called Shammad a criminal terrorist. The charges against him were never backed up with documentary evidence. The State Department had no comment about Shammad's case, but a spokesman said the U.S. has long opposed the way Iran carries out executions. According to human rights groups, Iran has executed more than 560 people this year. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
New information on the economy this week, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The Commerce Department reports this week on how much the U.S. economy grew in July, August, and September. We'll also learn how many jobs employers added in October. The monthly jobs report is expected to show some temporary weakness as a result of the Boeing strike and damage from hurricanes in the southeast. Quarter pounders are going back on the menu at hundreds of McDonald's restaurants after a brief suspension of sales due to an E. coli outbreak. Slivered onions on the burgers are the suspected culprit. The fast food chain is set to report quarterly earnings tomorrow. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks gain ground on Wall Street today. This is NPR. Conclave, a movie about the Vatican, did surprisingly well at the box office in its opening weekend. NPR's Bob Mondello has details.
It's not racy or scary like the Venom and Smile sequels that topped the box office list this weekend, but Conclave is definitely aimed at adults, both in subject matter, cardinals voting for a new pope, and in approach.
This is a conclave. It's not a war.
It is a war. And you have to commit to a side.
Seniors have been slow to commit to cinemas since the start of the pandemic, but almost half of Conclave's audience is 55 or older. That's a rarity in a movie that cracks the top 10. And with $6.5 million in the till, Conclave, at number 3, is in only about half as many theaters as the films that beat it. With the Dodgers-Yankees World Series siphoning audiences away, Hollywood's weekend as a whole was lackluster in North America, though results overseas were stronger. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
Uncrustables, those round white bread, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, are now a billion-dollar business. That's according to parent company J.M. Smucker, which says the sandwiches are so popular, the company now plans to open a third U.S. plant to produce them next year. Uncrustables, which have a hungry and devoted following among NFL football players, almost failed to take off. Smucker's says after the company bought the brand, it lost money for more than a decade as it sought to figure out how to mass produce the pillowy peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Crude oil futures prices took a tumble today, down more than 6% after Saturday's retaliatory strike by Israel against Iran bypassed oil facilities. Oil fell to $67.38 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Bob Schwartz Financial, helping Kansans make informed financial decisions for their families for over 45 years. More at bobschwartzfinancial.com.
We have a red flag warning till 8 o'clock tonight for Clay Cloud Dickinson, Gary Morris, Ottawa, and Riley counties. It is 4:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. IV fluids used in hospitals are still in short supply after Hurricane Helene shut down a key North Carolina factory that makes them. The closure has put hospitals in crisis mode and some patients in limbo, as NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin reports.
Katie Adace has been trying to get a diagnosis for her chronic pelvic pain for years, but so far, no doctor has been able to figure it out.
I couldn't do laundry or walk to the grocery store or like even cook without having to then take 3 or 4 hours to lay in bed with a heating pad. So it's been really scary.
The 26-year-old biologist eventually got referred to a physician who specializes in endometriosis. By the time she got the appointment, though, she had moved across the country. Diagnosing the cause of her symptoms required a surgery. The procedure was scheduled for early October. She and her husband flew back to West Virginia a few days before the pre-op appointment. While they were there, Hurricane Helene hit. 4 days before the scheduled surgery, a nurse called. The surgery was canceled because they didn't have enough IV fluids.
I was having such a hard time processing what she was even saying to me that I was just really quiet.
Her diagnosis would have to wait. That's a problem for patients around the country in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. The storm flooded a Baxter International factory in North Carolina that was making 60% of the national supply of IV fluids. Hospitals have had to adjust by conserving IV fluids for the neediest patients. Often that means asking emergency room patients to drink a Gatorade or a Pedialyte instead of getting an IV, but it also means canceling scheduled surgeries and procedures.
This shortage is still touching nearly every hospital in the country. Now I've talked to hospitals coast to coast, border to border, all over the country who are needing to engage in those kinds of measures.
That was Dr. Chris DiRienzo, chief physician executive of the American Hospital Association. The surgeries most likely to be postponed or canceled include certain bladder surgeries, which require a lot of IV fluids, some heart procedures, orthopedic surgeries, and things like Kaliadase's diagnostic surgery. But it varies from hospital to hospital. At Mass General Hospital in Boston, Dr. Paul Bidinger has handled disaster preparedness for more than two decades. He says the IV fluid shortage is a crisis.
We have activated our emergency operations plan for the system, and we've been in that mode now for weeks, the last couple weeks. And that is an all hands on deck. It's the same thing we do for a hurricane or the Boston Marathon bombing or COVID.
He said his hospital has been able to reduce IV fluid use by 50%, but it has taken a huge effort, and procedures still get pushed off. When it's a knee or hip replacement surgery that gets canceled, sometimes the patient has been waiting months already, and rebooking can take time.
And so they're in pain. They're at risk of falling. There are very real consequences to patients and their families.
Things are getting better as Baxter and the government work to bridge the supply gap while the North Carolina factory is cleaned up for reopening in phases. But it will take time for that supply to hit hospital loading docks. Baxter says it hopes to resume some production of the highest priority IV fluids very soon and is ahead of schedule. Some patients NPR spoke to say their canceled surgeries have since been rescheduled and happened without incident. As for Katie Adase in West Virginia, her surgery has been rescheduled for November 1st.
So that leaves me to, you know, fix up all of my logistics. So I'm racking up medical debt. I'm racking up debt from traveling. I'm feeling guilty that, you know, my husband took off work for nothing.
She says she's lucky to have the support system she has, but patients are paying a price even if things work out in the end. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
During World War II, the U.S. government incarcerated more than 120,000 Japanese Americans at camps across the country. One of the largest was Manzanar in the remote California desert. The camp was mostly demolished after the war, but for the last year, volunteers have been working to restore the baseball diamond that incarcerees once played on. Last weekend, for the first time since the war, it hosted a game, and NPR's Adrian Florido was in the bleachers.
All right, who's ready to have his very first exhibition game here at the Manzanar Baseball Field?
The face-off was between two well-established Japanese-American amateur teams, the Little Tokyo Giants from Los Angeles against the Templars from the city of Lodi.
Everybody get in here.
Before the first pitch, Dan Kwong, first baseman for the Giants, spoke to his team in a huddle.
You were the first people to play ball in over 8 years. Think about all the spirits who have played on this field. Let it hit you however it hits you. And have a good time.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Let's go, Giants.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kwong on three. One, two, three.
Kwong!
The Manzanar site is now administered by the National Park Service, but Kwong, an artist from the city of Santa Monica, was the leading force behind its ball field's restoration. He worked with volunteers for a year to clear tumbleweeds and rebuild the backstop. It's an all-dirt diamond in the desert, just like during the war. Two benches for dugouts, simple wooden bleachers. There's no outfield fence. If the ball lands in the tumbleweeds, it's a home run. An old camp guard tower still looms over the field. Dan Kwong's parents were among the 10,000 people held at Manzanar.
The reason why people were here, put in this camp, is because it was a time when Japanese heritage people were hated and feared in this country and distrusted in this country. And yet, they still were going to play the American game.
Carson, shorten the swing up a little bit, okay?
Marty Sakata is manager of the Lodi JACL Templar.
It's amazing to be out here in a field basically the same as during camp. This all dirt, rocky, slow field but with tumbleweeds. It's fantastic. It is fantastic.
Segregation before the war kept Japanese Americans out of white baseball leagues, so they formed their own. Sakata's team has been active since 1915, except when its players were sent to Manzanar during the war. Mike Furutani is a pitcher for the Templars. His uncles were incarcerated.
A lot of the people say a lot of things that sustained the community while they were in the camp was baseball. It was the thing that reminded them that they were still American. Right? It sucked, but they could still play ball and forget for 3 hours all the horrible things that are happening.
Furutani is one of the older players on his team. He says before today, many of the younger ones had only heard stories about the places where their ancestors were locked up.
But I don't think they've ever experienced how far, how desolate, and how, you know, horrible the situation was, the injustice.
Oh, yeah!
20-year-old Kainoa Sue is a star hitter on the Giants. He got the first hit and scored the first run of the game.
I got butterflies in my stomach right now just talking about it. I have lineage that was in this camp, so now being able to play on the same field in the same general area that they were in, it's insane.
Melinda Yamane Crawford was in the bleachers cheering on her son Robert, and also thinking about her dad, who served in the war, and a friend who had been locked up here.
That's a mix of emotions. You could tell I'm probably a little emotional right now because I'm honoring my father, I'm honoring my friend, but I'm also enjoying the game of baseball and watching my son carry on that tradition.
So who won the first game played on Manzanar's diamond in over 80 years? The Little Tokyo Giants. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Manzanar, California.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Donald Kabara. In the spring of 2023, Kabara visited Washington, D.C. with family members, including his son, Tim. On the last day of the trip, Kabara was scheduled to fly back home to Oklahoma, a trip that would begin with a ride to the airport on D.C.'s subway system, the Metro. Well, after they arrived at the Metro station, Tim insisted on walking his father inside. But when they got there, Kabara wasn't sure which train to take to get to the airport.
So I approached the attendant, a middle-aged woman, and asked her for directions to the train to Reagan Airport. She told me to pass through the gate, take the escalator down, and turn, go to the right, and the train should arrive there. So I gave my son one hug and a second hug, and he was standing next to me at her booth,